Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
It's scary for someone small to think about something big, you know, that happened.
Something big that happened. That thing we can't really wrap our heads around. More than 500,000 deaths. Lost jobs, mental health crisis, online school. Huge challenges, small victories. Today on our show, the one-year anniversary of COVID-19. From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. We begin with a look back at some of the people we've interviewed over the past 12 months, and we start in the small farming town of Woodlake. Since the pandemic, the botanical garden has been closed to visitors, so its creators, Manuel and Olga Jimenez, turned it into a memorial to those who have died of COVID in Tulare County. When our story about them aired back in June, 84 luminaries lined the main walkway.
It represents 84 people that have died, and the light has gone out of their life.
Well, you stand here and you look down and you see every individual luminary and representing one person. It's heartfelt.
Olga and Manuel still spend every Saturday making and lighting luminaries. Last week, 784 candles honored the dead. It's really sad to walk through the gardens on Saturday nights, Manuel recently told us. However, it's also very beautiful. This year we spoke several times with Dr. Patil Armenian. She's an emergency physician at Community Regional Medical Center. In April, she said the hospital was less crowded than expected. But by the summer,
the storm has definitely hit. It took a while. Every week we were saying it's the calm before the storm. It's the calm before the storm. And now we are in July and it's definitely here and it doesn't show signs of abating anytime soon.
As we well know, the summer surge was later dwarfed by the winter surge. When ICUs were packed to capacity, first responders had to turn away patients they judged weren't in true emergencies. And hundreds of hospital workers were forced to quarantine at home instead of treating patients. And still, a lot of people were not wearing masks. Here's what ICU nurse Amy Arland had to say.
This is what I'm talking about. This is why we're going to continue to have to stay in a lockdown, and we're going to continue to see hundreds and thousands of more people in our community die because of this just blatant disregard for this health crisis that we are in. It is not about religion. It is not about politics. It is about the preservation of human life. And that is what I am about as a nurse.
And even as healthcare workers felt overwhelmed by the pandemic, so did people being admitted to hospitals.
I cried every day, every night.
That was Parlier resident Jeanette Cisneros, who in July was alone in one hospital with COVID, while her parents were in two other hospitals with the virus. Her grandparents were also sick in yet another hospital.
It was very, very difficult for me and all by yourself and sorry.
Cisneros' grandparents both died of the virus. It's her 9-year-old sister, Brianna, who said this at the beginning of our show.
It's scary for someone small to think about something big, you know, that happened.
People without COVID were also fearful about going to a hospital. In April, we told you about 26-year-old Brianna Gaines, who was due to deliver a baby without family members by her side.
I do my best to try to keep calm, but I'm like looking at stuff like, you know, in the hospitals, you know, women, you know, aren't able to have the support people that they need during labor. And that's, for me, that part is so stressful. I'm like, women need support, you know, during labor. Even if I wasn't a doula, I couldn't imagine you know, doing a labor, you know, by myself.
Fortunately, her husband was able to join her. Now her baby is almost 1 year old and walking. This year, we also told you about the COVID crisis in detention centers, jails, and prisons, where social distancing is nearly impossible. In July, Jacob Benitez, an inmate at Avenal State Prison in Kings County, talked about the mental toll of postponed visitations.
The only way we can stay in touch with loved ones right now is through this state phone that we're speaking on now and through letters. That's it. And it's real tough. It's real tough. Just last night, I was talking to my wife, and she told me that she forgot my face. She forgot what I looked like in person. And it's real sad, you know. And I told her, you know, I almost feel the same. I can remember just a few things, but it does put a strain on your relationship, and you do the best you can with the means that you have.
Since then, more than 3,000 inmates and employees at Avenal have been infected with the virus, more than any other prison in the country. Recently, inmates have been allowed video conversations, but loved ones still have not been allowed to visit. Loved ones. Those key words that, in the pandemic, have sometimes meant staying away to protect those we care about the most. Grandparents missing out on seeing their grandchildren. Couples separated by jobs or borders. So many Zoom calls. And the cancellation of events that celebrate family and culture. Here's Blong Zhang talking about the isolation the Hmong community felt when the largest New Year celebration in the country was canceled in December.
I think every community has a family, you know, atmosphere, but ours really is truly connected through that way. Our gathering is about family. Our food is about our family. Our event is about family. And the pandemic is not.
We've learned so much this year about everything the pandemic is and isn't. Our reporting told us how alone and afraid many people felt, but also how resilient human beings are. Up next on Valley Edition, we'll tell you more about how the game changer in this indescribable year, the vaccine, is rolling out. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Even as we look back, it's also useful to look forward to the vaccine rollout. It's been 2 weeks since Governor Gavin Newsom announced a state plan to get at least 2 million doses to people in underserved communities in order to fix disparities in the vaccine process. FM89's Madi Bolaños checks in with community organizations to see what they're doing to help boost vaccination rates in the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello. Hi. Can I leave you with a flyer?
That's Madeline Harris with the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. Today, she's knocking on doors in Fairmead, a small community in Madera County, to let residents know about a mobile vaccine clinic coming to the town.
About a vaccine clinic they're going to do at the school on Sunday.
On Sunday? Mm-hmm. Do you have to have an appointment? Or?
No, it's on-site registration, and it's for people who are food and ag workers. So
Harris is talking to Marianne Moore, who moved to Fairmead 5 years ago. She says she likes living here because it's quiet, but the community's location is remote. That means that during the pandemic, it's been hard to get COVID-19 information from her local health department. She says this is the first time someone has shown up at her doorstep with information about the vaccine.
My daughter's going to go online and make us an appointment because I'm just able and can't do much.
Moore doesn't work, so she's not eligible to get the vaccine on Sunday. For other people who don't qualify, Harris offered to take their information to let them know of future mobile clinics. As she wedges a flyer through someone's front gate, Harris says residents in communities like Fairmead face a lot of challenges signing up for the vaccine.
And a lot of people who are at work when these, you know, links are posted or who don't have internet access or use computers or speak English aren't able to get those appointments.
So going door to door eliminates some of those barriers, she says. And the clinic on Sunday, which is partnered with the governor's office, is a part of a larger effort to get vaccine appointments for rural residents.
It's really important to us to bring the vaccine to where people are.
Last week, the state met its 2 million dose goal for underserved communities. Still, just 20% of all 12.6 million vaccinations administered to date have gone towards Black and Latino communities. These new efforts are welcome, Harris says, but they are just one step in the process. She says health officials should also work with grassroots organizations to reach the people that have been most impacted by COVID.
If local governments are going to utilize their existing channels of communications or existing infrastructures to do a project as big as vaccinating the entire, you know, eligible population who wants the vaccine, then the same institutional racism that's embedded in those institutions is going to replicate itself with vaccine distribution.
In Orange Cove, a rural city in the far east corner of Fresno County, another community organization is partnering with St. Agnes Hospital and the Fresno State Nursing Program to help residents with the vaccine process.
So Cultiva la Salud is here at the Orange Cove High School at this beautiful day, helping to register community residents.
That's Genoveva Islas, director of Cultiva la Salud, an organization that spent the last year helping Spanish-speaking residents navigate the pandemic. She says getting people to the vaccine clinic requires a lot of outreach effort. Sometimes she'll send organizers to local grocery stores or food distribution events in the days leading up to the mobile clinic.
It's a great way to capture people, right? And to announce, hey, you're here to pick up food today, but if you're also interested in this vaccine and you're eligible, call this number and we'll help register you.
She says the majority of people she's spoken to who live in rural areas in the San Joaquin Valley have shown a high interest in getting the vaccine. Yet many have limited access to health care. That's another reason why mobile vaccination clinics in areas like these are crucial, she says.
We don't have the great public transportation from our county rural communities to the center of Fresno. So coming out and doing these mobile clinics, I think, is the other benefit that people do like and want to take advantage of.
Farm worker Sergio Gomez is among 150 people who got their second dose of the Moderna vaccine at the Orange Cove Clinic. He says he was hesitant at first to get the vaccine because he was worried about potential side effects.
I saw it in the news and in the radio that a lot of people were getting sick, but my friends encouraged me to get it.
Genoveva Islas says she's heard that fear from some people in these areas, and another part of outreach is combating that misinformation.
Truth is that some people do have reactions, but that is by no means as severe as if they should get the full breadth of the virus.
That's why she says it's a good thing that Newsom is prioritizing vaccinations for underserved communities, and it's gradually paying off. She says local organizations are now vaccinating more people.
These are the same communities who have consistently been putting their lives at risk for us, right, as farm laborers. And so that feels like the right and fair thing to do, to prioritize them.
She says local organizations will continue working with vaccine providers to bring mobile vaccine clinics to the communities that need them. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation, with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Kathleen Schock. Efforts to vaccinate people are underway, but that may be little solace to those who have lost family members. In the last year, more than 538,000 people have died in the United States due to COVID. In August, FM89's Alice Daniel told us the story of one of them, Sue Tao, a Hmong businessman and filmmaker who had a profound impact on thousands of others.
What you're hearing is a documentary produced in Burma in the late 90s. Two young Hmong women in traditional dress are dancing encircled by other villagers. They're singing a goodbye song to filmmaker Sue Tao, who came from Fresno to make this video. Here's his son, Steve Tao.
He went to Burma to find kind of like the lost Hmong people there. Did a documentary, the whole town came out to welcome him, and he had a conversation with the village elders.
A lively conversation full of laughter. It was a big deal, Steve says, because it gave other Hmong communities all over the world a chance to compare culture, history, and life experiences. But it was also a dangerous trip because of Burma's civil war. By the time Sue Tao made this documentary, he'd already been a well-known film distributor of videos dubbed in Hmong, mostly romantic and action films from Thailand, as well as films from Bollywood.
A lot of the homes in America would have these videos. We would send, thousands of videos across the country.
Steve says his dad also made documentaries of his native Laos in the early 90s, years after he and thousands of other Hmong came to the United States as refugees.
The government was still closed off to most people, so it was really an amazing thing for people here to see Hmong people in Laos, see the land of their forefathers and see some of their relatives on video.
For 15 years, the U.S. fought a secret war against the communist Pathet Lao and the North Vietnamese, not with American troops, but with native Laotians instead, tens of thousands of them, Hmong tribesmen.
Like many older Hmong refugees in Fresno, Sue fought in the CIA's secret war in Laos. Steve Tao says his dad, who spoke English, was a second lieutenant and helped direct bombers and fighter pilots on air missions. When the Pathet Lao won the Civil War in 1975, Sue and his family tried to get on one of the planes that General Vang Pao had brought in for officers like him. Steve was only 5 years old.
I think it was the last C-130, and I remember him throwing me onto the plane, and I just remember the image of people all over. And there's an iconic picture of a C-130 with thousands of people around it.
Sue and Steve both got on the plane headed to Thailand, but somehow in the crush of desperate people pushing to get on board, Sue's pregnant wife and daughter got separated from him and didn't make it on the plane. Many of Sue's other family members were also stuck in Laos. His niece, Tru Chang, says her family was terrified Vietnamese soldiers would kill them. But one night,
they heard footsteps outside the door. They thought, oh my gosh, you know, we are going to be caught now. And they all were frightened. They started crying, and the footsteps got closer to the door.
There was a knock on the door. Their hearts stopped. They thought, this is it. But then they heard a familiar voice. It was Sue Tao. He had come back to Laos from Thailand to rescue the rest of his family.
And they opened the door, and Uncle Sue set you down. Don't worry, I'm going to take you guys.
He hired a bus and bribed some patrol guards to let them through. He talks about the journey in a documentary by Michael Corpy called City of Refuge.
May 14, 1975, on that day we lost our country to the communists, and we decided to flee to Thailand. Finally, we crossed the Mekong River safely into Thailand. We stayed in the refugee camp 10 months, and then we came to America.
Sue's family was sponsored by the Third Reformed Church in Pella, Iowa, a Dutch immigrant town known as the City of Refuge. His family was the first to arrive in Iowa, but many others followed.
Pella is a small town in Iowa. It is like many other small towns, but this town is unmistakably Dutch. Many people in Pella are direct descendants of the Dutch immigrants who founded the city. This film is a record of how the Dutch immigrants opened their community to the new immigrants from Laos.
Oh, yeah.
After a couple of years, Sue got a job working for the Iowa Refugee Services in Des Moines. He helped new Hmong families acclimate and find jobs. He worked long hours translating.
I received a phone call, I might say almost 24 hours, even at work and at home. In the midnight, doctors, and they need interpretation, they just call me. Or refugees, they need help, they call me at home.
But Sue and his family missed Pella, and they often drove back on the weekends to attend the Hmong Christian church. Sue had been raised Christian in Laos. Sue moved to Fresno in the early 90s. He wanted to be around a large Hmong community where he could find actors to dub film parts. Just this year, he had agreed to move to Minnesota, where several of his 9 children live. But in June, he had a stroke. He needed physical therapy, so he went to a rehab facility at a nursing home. His daughter, Von Tao, says the plan was to keep him there for 4 to 6 weeks and then bring him home. But instead, he got a fever and started shaking.
They just sent him to Clovis Community Hospital, and as soon as he got there, they tested him right away, and he was positive for coronavirus.
He'd been in high spirits, Von says, but the virus made him so ill. She and her siblings saw him multiple times over a Zoom connection on the internet. The first day, he gave them the thumbs up. On the last day, July 30th, he had an oxygen mask.
And then we didn't think he could hear us, but he did. Because the way he was sitting was kind of like on his side. And the nurse was wiping tears with the tissue.
It was surreal, Vaughn says, even eerie, to watch her 72-year-old father die, not in person, but over a screen.
It was a real struggle to watch him breathe and not be able to. It was like watching him suffocate.
The disease is horrible, Vaughn says, but what she really hates is that people are dismissive when someone who is older dies from it.
Because the old people is somebody's mom or dad or somebody's brother, uncle.
Somebody's brother, uncle, father. Su Tao was all that. But he was also someone who did so much for the Hmong community. If his life hadn't been cut short by the virus, Vaughn wonders, what other amazing things might he have done? For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
This year, we aired many stories about people detained at Mesa Verde, the ICE processing facility in Kern County. FM89's Mari Bolaños has this story about the first woman released at the start of the pandemic. She was part of a class action lawsuit against the facility.
Sofia Bajena Ortuno is 64 years old. She's been a farm worker in Kern County for 20 years.
Por mis hijos he sido capaz de hacer.
I did what I had to do for my kids. They accused me of entering this place illegally, but it was for the good of my family, the good of my kids, to give them a better life. She suffers from underlying health conditions that make her a high-risk candidate for COVID-19. I have diabetes. My toes are infected. I've been getting more and more headaches. ICE detained Sofia in October when she was on her way to work to pick yams. She was in the passenger seat of her coworker's car when they were pulled over. We thought it was the sheriff. My friend asked, why are they pulling us over? But they didn't answer. They just asked us for our license and registration. Eventually, Sofia realized they were with ICE. We were nearly in tears when we realized it was them, because we knew they had been making rounds and detaining all of the people. ICE arrested and detained Sofia during a traffic stop. Since then, she has shared a room with about 50 other women at the Mesa Verde Detention Center. Based on what she had seen on the news, she feared contracting the coronavirus or spreading it to other women. I was sad and stressed what to think. If I was to get sick there, I might contract the virus. or if someone infected with the virus were to come in and give it to me, then I might give it to other women.
Sophia says ICE continued to bring new people to the center. The women slept in bunk beds that are very close together. The ICE officers did not wear masks or communicate safe practices either.
They never told us anything. We just talked about how scared we were among ourselves. But they never said, you need to cover up with something. They themselves came in and left every day and did not wear any mask. They had no added protection.
When Sophia's lawyer learned her underlying conditions and age made her a high-risk candidate for COVID-19, he quickly put in a request to get her out of detention.
I actually got a call from ICE telling me that they were, looking into this and that I would hear back from them. I then, learned more information about her health. It made me even more concerned, so I, filed a subsequent request, later that day, and then I never heard back from them.
Judah Lincoln has represented Sophia since she was detained thanks to family members who worked hard to get her a lawyer. He's since teamed up with other lawyers and organizations, including the ACLU, to file a lawsuit in which Sophia is the lead plaintiff. The lawsuit demands the release of 13 at-risk immigrants from two ICE detention centers, Mesa Verde and Yuba County Jail.
As soon as we filed the lawsuit, or told the opposing counsel that we were going to file the lawsuit and listed the plaintiffs and their A numbers, it appears that's what ultimately moved them to release Sophia.
Sophia was released hours before the lawsuit was made public, but she says officials did not give her an explanation.
I didn't understand what was going on. For me, it was impossible that they let me go, just because. But I think they were scared that I will get more sick.
Sophia remains the only plaintiff on the case to be released. She is staying with family while she awaits her follow-up appointment with ICE.
I'm still worried about contracting the coronavirus, given my health. But I'm very happy to be able to be with my family again and to live with them, even if it's a bit restricted.
ICE did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The ACLU is now asking for the release of 24 more at-risk people detained at Mesa Verde, including a 74-year-old man who was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Madi Bolaños.
We reached out to Sophia this week. She says she's now living in a trailer that her family rented for her, and she checks in with ICE officials regularly. Due to the pandemic, her court hearing was... We reached out to Sophia this week. She says she's now living in a trailer that her family rented for her, and she checks in with ICE officials regularly. Due to the pandemic, her court hearing regarding her legal status was postponed, but it looks like a hearing is set for April. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today's retrospective wouldn't be complete without a COVID-19 update, which we've been bringing you every week since June. Today, FM89's Carrie Klein is here to walk us through how the pandemic has affected the Valley in the last year. She also reconnects with two people she spoke to earlier in the pandemic, who talk about the effects in prisons and on those with compromised immune systems. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Before we look back, can we begin with our usual status report?
Of course. So infection rates and death rates are continuing to improve in this area, and so are hospital occupancies. When it comes to the vaccine, vaccine administration is now far outpacing new cases, which is good news. Nearly 750,000 doses have been given here in the Valley so far, and we are not as far below average for vaccine administration as we used to be. Now, for business reopenings, Tulare County became the second Valley County to graduate out of the purple most restrictive tier of the state's reopening blueprint. It's now in red, and Mariposa County has been out for a while and is now in orange. But even though all other counties in the Valley continue to progress, that progress has slowed. The state requires a county to qualify for the next tier for 2 weeks before it can officially move there, but none of the remaining Valley counties have begun qualifying for the red tier just yet. And so even though there's a lot of optimism right now, the new daily case rates are still around where they were in late October or earlier November, as health officials began warning of a winter surge. They're also where we were in mid-June before the summer surge began.
That's a good reminder that we've been through so much in the last year. Take us back to March 2020, when all of this was first emerging.
Right. Well, like so many places in this country, the virus really crept up on us. You know, some of the first cases we were aware of in the Valley were associated with those Princess cruise liners that were forced to quarantine at sea before coming into port. But as we now know, the virus already had been spreading within the community at that point. And by mid-March, cities and counties were issuing local emergencies, and shelter-in-place orders had come down from Governor Newsom. At the 10,000-foot view, what's happened here since then is what's happened everywhere else across the country. I mean, we've been facing just incredible joblessness and business closures, lost income, and the circumstances that accompany all of that, like food insecurity and a looming eviction crisis. Schools were shuttered in the middle of last spring. Virtual learning has been kind of a mixed bag for students. There's a mental health crisis. Some organizations and health departments have reported seeing spikes in suicide attempts and drug overdoses. The federal government's stimulus bills have helped with some of this, providing unemployment benefits and cash, loans to businesses, and assistance for local governments with their own bills, as well as things like rental and utility bill assistance for residents.
So that was the 10,000-foot view. What do the numbers say about the virus here in the Valley?
Well, since the pandemic began, more than 320,000 people in the Valley have tested positive for the virus. That's more than 11% of our entire population. And that's a disparity right there, because across the rest of the state, less than 9% of all Californians have had the virus. And then of those cases in the Valley, 4,200 of them, so that's 4,200 grandparents and loved ones and friends, have died. However, when I analyzed death data earlier in the pandemic, it was clear that far more people died in 2020 than on average, and that the official death toll related to COVID cannot account for all of those excess deaths. And that's consistent with what epidemiologists are finding all across the country. And it implies that either there are more health complications from COVID than we know of, or that far more people are dying indirectly from other consequences of the pandemic that are harder to quantify. And then also, like with so many health measures in this pandemic, people of color are overrepresented in these excess deaths.
Early on, it also became clear that essential workers were risking their health and sometimes their lives to keep working. Let's talk about the Valley's essential workers.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And although essential workers are everywhere, agriculture in particular is huge in this part of the state. And, you know, multiple studies have shown elevated economic troubles, higher infection rates, and higher death rates among food and ag workers than other industries. And we've had a few very tragic examples of that here in the Valley. 14 workers died and hundreds of others were infected at Foster Farms poultry plants in Fresno and Merced counties. Another died in a large outbreak at Primex Farms in Kern County. Now, however, farm workers are given vaccine priority, and some counties are even sending mobile clinics out to vaccinate people where they work. And of course, frontline workers in lots of industries have been at risk. You know, at the height of the winter surge, so many patients were hospitalized with COVID that hundreds of healthcare workers at a time had to be home quarantining instead of seeing patients. We can't know all of those who have died, but, you know, among them were a nurse at Kaiser Permanente in Fresno who died last spring after raising concerns about inadequate PPE at her hospital. We lost police officers in Fresno, a sheriff's deputy in Tulare County, three prison workers in Kern and Madera counties, and the list goes on and on and on.
Some Valley nursing homes were also hotspots early in the pandemic. What happened with them and other congregate living facilities?
Well, nursing homes in Fresno and Visalia are no longer among the hardest hit in the state. They had been, as you said, but the local toll has still been tremendous. In the Valley, 400 nursing home residents have died of the virus, and thousands of other residents and staff members have been infected. Another crisis has been in correctional facilities. Earlier this week, I spoke about COVID in prisons with Don Spector. He's the executive director of the Prison Law Office.
It's just been a disaster in any way you cut it, and efforts to decarcerate the prison population have had very limited success in the political arena and in the courts, which has allowed the virus to spread throughout the prison system.
More than half of all state prisoners have contracted the virus, and more than 200 died. And as we've reported before, the hardest hit prisons in the entire country are here in Kings County, Avenal State Prison, and the Substance Abuse Treatment Facility in Corcoran. Specter mentioned decarceration. And although the governor's office did release close to 20,000 inmates early last year, Specter said it wasn't enough and it didn't target the most at-risk inmates.
It was targeted mainly at people who are going to go home anyway. And those tend to be the younger folks who are in there for shorter sentences instead of the older people with medical conditions.
There's also this question of herd immunity. In some prisons like Avenal, where 9 out of 10 inmates have already contracted the virus, are they safe now? Specter, of course, is not a medical professional, but he says herd immunity in a prison is wishful thinking.
It's a fluid population. People go in and out of there all the time. The staff come in and out of there all the time. So it's not just the same, 3,000 people who are there all the time either.
And so he says, just like in the general population, the vaccine is the next best thing for prisons. That program has already begun. And in fact, nearly 70,000 inmates have gotten at least one dose.
And all of this has been with a backdrop of ever-changing guidelines and policies from the state, which I know some of your sources have been unhappy about.
Right. So because the response to this pandemic has been so decentralized, every county is at the mercy of guidelines set by its health department, and all of those are in turn guided by the governor. You know, early on, Newsom was praised for being the first governor in the country to issue shelter-in-place orders. But as time wore on and it became clear this pandemic was going to last, those orders needed to evolve. And so the state later established a county monitoring system where each county was getting individual attention from the state. That turned into the blueprint for a safer economy. And that's in effect now. That's what assigns each county a color, according to how businesses there can reopen. And then, of course, around the holidays, Newsom put that blueprint on hold in favor of regional shelter-in-place orders. So just like that sounds confusing, just going through it, it was confusing even to county administrators as well. And so administrators in Kern County in particular felt that Valley counties have been punished and overlooked in this blueprint in these ever-changing policies, and that overly restrictive reopening guidelines have really hurt businesses.
Okay, so now we're on what many feel is the final stretch. How has the vaccine rollout gone so far?
So I don't know if anyone would call the vaccine rollout smooth so far. Our allocation changes every week. There have been holdups due to weather, due to the cold chain breaking down. There was a federal backup supply and then there wasn't, but things do keep chugging along. The newest development is that starting this past Monday, Californians age 16 to 64 are now eligible if they have conditions that make them more vulnerable to the virus. Things like cancer, lung or kidney disease, an organ transplant, diabetes. And so to talk about what this means, I got back in touch with Rachel Goldring Bell. She's a 20-something psychology student in Clovis with 3 serious conditions: congenital heart disease, pulmonary hypertension, and an autoimmune disorder. When I spoke with her in August, she hadn't been out of her house since March. She told me this week that that couldn't last forever. She stopped counting at around 120 days, then broke her lockdown sometime after that.
I was miserable. I mean, I was depressed. I had tons of anxiety. And when you live at that heightened anxiety, heightened depression state, it's unhealthy.
She worked with a therapist and her family to move beyond a narrative of fear, she called it, and just to accept certain risks. She's spent small amounts since then of time with family, including her sister, who just had a baby on the East Coast. Goldring Bell told me she actually qualified for an earlier tier of the vaccine, and she feels like some of the weight of the pandemic has been lifted. And so she's thrilled that other people like her are now eligible.
I am ecstatic. I know one of my friends who has my heart disease. I'm grateful that I'm grateful they get to get it now, because I think that should have been one of the very first tiers to be able to get vaccinated. I mean, we are the most vulnerable being chronically sick.
She has told me before that because her illnesses are internal and she looks able-bodied, she's not always taken seriously as someone with a disability. I asked her if she felt this pandemic had increased the public understanding at all around chronic conditions. And she said, not really, at least not for people like her.
I feel like this pandemic, it was still centered around the older population, which I completely understand, but people don't necessarily think of young adults with chronic issues.
But one thing she is excited about is how much more careful we all are about hand hygiene and protecting others from coughs and sneezes.
That's a silver lining. Well, Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And thank you for all the reporting you've done throughout this pandemic.
You're welcome.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. One of the last in-person interviews I conducted inside a studio at Valley Public Radio was with board-certified psychiatrist Dr. Jasmine Singh. I recently spoke with her again, this time via Zoom, about anxiety, depression, collective trauma, and what the pandemic has done to our mental health.
So when we first talked almost a year ago exactly, you know, we were focusing our conversation on panic and anxiety, which I think was right for those, you know, first weeks and those first days of the lockdown. But it seems, based on my experience and in talking with friends and family and what I've seen in the media, that we shifted from that sort of heightened state down into depression. Collectively speaking, is that what you observed?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the initial reaction that we had was of shock, of panic, of fear. And then once it did arrive, meaning once the pandemic, once COVID-19 did reach us, we learned different ways to handle it. And, you know, the environment of being isolated, having to remain at home, this threat outside of our homes, it's a perfect recipe for depression, quite frankly. On top of that, there were so many economic losses and people lost their jobs, and financially people struggled, again, while isolated away from friends and family and with a looming threat of a perhaps deadly virus. So that's a very easy way to become depressed.
This is sort of a purposely vague question, but professionally, as a mental health professional, what has this year been like for you?
So this past year, working in mental health as a psychiatrist has been interesting. Now, usually when you're working in a group or in a residency, you have many people around you, you have superior physicians around you, you can talk to, but that was not the case for me until recently. So what doctors have developed is a way to communicate with each other in spite of being so isolated. Now, in the mental health world, that means we are seeking supervision through Zoom or the telephone and discussing on how to handle difficult cases. So our way to collaborate has changed. Now, there's a bigger picture here of how physicians are interacting. And I'm happy to say that in the early days of the pandemic, physicians in the United States were hearing from physicians in China and Italy. And I just thought the beauty of medicine and of this camaraderie was exactly the strength-based response that we needed to face the pandemic. And that was very moving to me, that all of the healthcare workers on the planet are getting together to talk about how to handle this new crisis.
There's obviously a desire for us all to return to normal. But it seems that what we've been through collectively over the past year has been like walking through fire, and we are going to be different on the other side of it. From a mental health perspective, what are the issues that you anticipate people might face as we move back into quote unquote normal?
I think the issues that we are going to face are only going to be an extension of what we're already facing. The number of people suffering from anxiety and depression has quadrupled from pre-pandemic times. And this is something that people are studying now. So people are already doing unwell. And to now place the task of now we're going to, you know, everything's fine now, go back to normal, I think that's unrealistic. So we need to still continue to treat patients, whether that's depression, whether that's anxiety, whether that's PTSD. All of these illnesses need treatment. And people are currently suffering, and there's a chance that just because things are now open, things aren't just going to disappear in terms of their mental illness symptoms. So I think we need to have a realistic and fact-based look at how things are going to be going forward, meaning people are suffering now, and there's a chance that they'll continue to suffer unless they have the proper mental health care.
How might the mental health impact of this pandemic be intergenerational?
Yes. So this is a very important point. Now, currently, psychiatric studies have been looking at what is intergenerational trauma. And so to put it very plainly, If someone is traumatized, there's a chance that their child could also develop such symptoms. So this can be thought of very simply, meaning someone who is traumatized could develop an internalized idea that the world is unsafe and threat is looming. And so these kind of ideals could be passed to their children through their behaviors and through their thoughts and through their actions and words, meaning a way of looking at the world through traumatized eyes. Now, that makes sense, but, and you know, it can be altered, meaning changing behaviors, changing thoughts, and your worldview about the world being a dangerous place. However, more studies are showing that there's actually a genetic component that when someone is traumatized, their genes even change. And those changes in the genetic code are also passed to their children. So there's a lot to study here, but for what we know today, the best way to approach this is to get treatment for depression, anxiety, and PTSD so that the chances of intergenerational trauma are reduced.
One of the things that I have been hearing from people of late is that there's this sense that we've been through this incredibly significant transformative event, but there's no sort of ritual or moment or marker that we can point to say, you know, we made it or it's over, right? Or, you know, and we've had attempts, you know, to memorialize the dead, but nothing seems to be quite big enough to signify the magnitude of this experience. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts or your suggestions about things that we could do, practices, rituals, to help us honor this moment in time?
Yes, absolutely. I think it is important that we honor this moment, whatever that means to each individual. Now, unfortunately, I don't think there will be something like when wars ended and, you know, people would celebrate on the streets. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have that kind of a release or ritual or celebration. But what we can have is an individual one. Now, does that mean the first time you dine outdoors? That's something to celebrate. The first time you go back to, you know, doing a certain activity that has been prohibited for so long. These little changes that are going back towards our previous pre-pandemic life, those are worth celebrating. And unfortunately, you know, it can't be a huge global celebration, but for us, we must honor these little steps that we take. Now, if someone feels anxious, it may be something much smaller, like taking a walk or, you know, something much more simpler, that's also worth celebrating too. But I do feel for all of us that we don't have that kind of big party, so to speak. But maybe that's in the future. Maybe in some time we'll have our return to life how it was, and we'll have such parties. And at that moment, it may feel normal again to us. And hopefully, and even at that point, we can be grateful that we've moved forward from the pandemic.
Can you just speak a bit about this whole idea of collective trauma and how it plays out? I mean, it definitely feels as if there's a collective grief process that has occurred or is occurring, even for those who were fortunate enough not to lose someone in the past 12 months.
Yes, absolutely. So collective trauma, meaning a group of people united in some sort of way, whether geographically or otherwise, go through a trauma together, meaning they're all facing the same traumatic issue. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that they understand each other, hopefully, a little bit more than someone who didn't go through that trauma. And I think the impact of what this could do is it could create an increased collective consciousness. Now, does that mean a change that the culture wants to make? Does that mean an appreciation for something different? I think we can all agree that there's been an increased appreciation for science and for immunology and an increased appreciation for human connection that we've noticed. We have all been isolated and everyone seems to be missing all of the people that we interact with. So how does a collective trauma move forward? Well, it goes through changes that can happen. Perhaps there will be an increased focus on our human connection, on how we treat others, on how we value each other. That would be a very positive outcome of this collective trauma that we've been through. But it could also go the other way too. There could also be negative consequences, but let's hope that they're only positive.
And might another silver lining in this be that we're certainly having more open conversations about mental health?
Absolutely, yes. Now it's become nearly commonplace to hear about anxiety and depression nowadays, more so than it was even in the past. And I think that is a positive. You know, I do think that if there is illness, it should be treated. I wish it didn't take a pandemic for it to become so commonplace to discuss these issues, but here we are, and hopefully that leads people to take care of their mental health in a way that they didn't before.
Is there anything else you want to make sure we cover before we wrap up?
I just wish people good health, and I feel for people who have lost someone. You know, the odds are most people have. And just to not suppress their grief. Loss of a human or a loved one is the worst kind of loss. But we've all had other losses too. The loss of our typical life, of what we know to be normal, the loss of relationships, the loss of jobs. And I think somewhere a sense of loss of how things are going to be going forward. They likely will not be, at least in the near future, exactly how they used to be before the pandemic. But if you are struggling and if you think you need help, please, at that point, please reach out to someone. There is a suicide hotline. Suicides have increased globally. So please reach out. You are hurting and someone will be there to help you. See a doctor, see a psychiatrist, but just let anyone know because you deserve to feel much better.
Well, Dr. Jasmine Singh, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.